Well, hello everyone. On today's video, we're going to be looking at the Latin Europeans. Who is that exactly? Well, we're talking mainly about the people of the Iberian Peninsula, that's Spain and Portugal, people of Italy, of course, and Greece. I guess in the vernacular, we'd call them Meds, the Mediterranean Europeans. And if you recall last week, we were reading from this book, The Character of Peoples by André Siegfried. And this is the second chapter, which he has called Latin Realism. I'm fascinated to know what he thinks of as the character of the Meds. Before we get going, one of the great things the so-called Meds gave us, of course, was the trivium. You know, classical logic, classical rhetoric, and of course, grammar, writing. And I provide the trivium here on the academic agency. I'll just play my advert before we get going, and then I'm going to read this chapter in its entirety, and I'm pretty excited to get through this whole book. Notably, he separates out the French. Being a French author, André Siegfried didn't lump in. You sometimes see the French lumped in with the Latin Europeans, but they've got their own chapter. All right. By the trivium, folks, and when I come back, I'll hit this chapter.
Academic agency.
All right, let's not waste any further time. Siegfried writes, this is page 29. I'm going to say if you're following along, but I mean, there's going to be about three of you who have a copy of this book. This is why I'm making this available. All right, he says, in Europe, there is a Latin spirit without which our civilization would not have attained its traditional balance. Its intellectual realism provides a counterweight to Anglo-Saxon dynamism, to the extent to which the latter tends to diverge from classic tradition. Cut away from its Latin roots, the extreme West in the New World would no doubt remain Western, but in the long run, its destiny would inevitably take a different path. What is the Latin spirit? People often speak of Latin races, but if we use the term a race in its proper sense, then the Latins are not a race at all. On the other hand, there are certainly Latin languages, the instrument of a certain expression of thought which unquestionably correspond to a civilization which had its cradle in the Mediterranean. From this standpoint, the Latin spirit we are discussing is an obvious reality. Many, many races have contributed to the formation of the Mediterranean type. The oldest and most representative is the Iberian. White, dolichocephalic, small, with rather delicate bone structure, and a dark complexion. I don't know about you, friends, but I'm picturing Barcelona's team, you know, Xavi and Iniesta and all those sorts of guys. But that's just me, of course. It is different geographically from the Negroid type, which is also dolichocephalic, but black, and from the Alpine and Celtic types, which are brachycephalic, and from the Scandinavian or Nordic type, which is also dolichocephalic, but fair-haired and fair-complexioned. The ethnic domain of the Iberian is the western part of the Mediterranean. The Berbers, the Italians, the French of the Midi, and the Spaniards. The unifying factor is Euro-African, and in this connection, we may recall the Roman Empire, which was based on the axis of the inland sea, Mare Nostrum. But the Iberians are not alone in the Mediterranean. because infiltrations and repeated invasions have brought in heterogeneous elements. The Nordics, always attracted by the appeal of the south and the sun, frequently invaded Greece, Italy, Gaul, and Spain, finally reaching even the northern coasts of Africa. They were invariably assimilated, but their presence has always remained tangible. We know the theory of the racialists. Everything good in the Mediterranean comes from the north. He's talking about you watching this. I'm only joking. Wherever one meets with the will to command, with order and discipline, its origin is always Nordic. Jesus Christ, the Galilean, is also said to have belonged to the superior race of Dolingphalanx. The theory is ridiculous, but that does not mean it is utterly devoid of sense, for the famous axiom, Gratia Capta, need not be taken narrowly. The Arabs, for example, the white Semites, have exercised no small ethnic influence. Their presence made itself felt through the southeast and the south of the Mediterranean, where they founded a civilization which bears their indelible mark. It was they who developed the science of irrigation and introduced various tropical cultures such as cotton, rice, the sugarcane, and citrus fruits. They, so to speak, meridionalized the Mediterranean. But at the same time, they contributed to the ruin of the ancient unity of the Mediterranean civilization as it was known to the Roman world. It is due to them that the Mediterranean is no longer exclusively a Christian sea. The Turks, the Mongols, must not be left out of the account. I'll just repeat that. He just says the Turks, and then it says dash, the Mongols, must not be left out of the account. In many of these old books, they basically say that, like, yeah, those guys from the steppes, basically, is what he's trying to say. They are not truly Mediterraneans either, by culture or origin, but they arrived on the coasts of a sea, which to a large extent they dominated, although they remained strangers. They were landsmen, and only the periphery of its maritime atmosphere was theirs. And, unlike the Arabs, their contribution, both military and political, remained sterile. From 1453, the year of the taking of Constantinople, that's your Mehmed II, history fans, they turned that historic corridor of intercontinental communications into a cul-de-sac. Until the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, the ancient route of the Eastern Mediterranean remained blocked and practically unusable. Now, I'm not going to pause too much. My understanding is that this is a bit of an overstatement by Siegfried. I've had a look into what the Turks actually did in, you know, quote unquote, cutting off the Silk Road there. What Mehmed and co ended up doing was they put pretty heavy levies on there. So it became quite expensive to go through the gates of Constantinople and use the traditional Silk Road. So they didn't actually like block it. They just kind of, you had to pay a pretty big tariff to go through there. Kind of the same thing, but it's just a point of order, really. Where in that mixture are we to find the unity of the Latin race? On the other hand, Latin civilization is an obvious reality. Many and varied influences have contributed to its formation. There was the Roman influence, and in particular, the Roman Catholic influence. There was the Hellenic influence through the intermediary of Rome, and there were certain infiltrations from the east through Greece and through the Arabs. The geographic ambient of Latiny is essentially that of the old Roman Empire, but not wholly so. The Eastern Mediterranean, and in particular Asia Minor, has largely been overlaid by the Turkish invasion, as was the African Mediterranean by Islam. In this way, Greece was affected by Turkish influences and Spain by Arab influences. But today, the Latin spirit extends to what is called Latin, Spanish, and Portuguese America, which, as a result, possesses an unquestionable cultural unity, though no doubt under the new skies and integrity of the original tradition is menaced by what he calls here exotic contaminations. Exotic contaminations. The presence of native Indians, the colored element, threatens to insinuate disquieting ferments without relation to the Mediterranean source from which that tradition originally came. Nevertheless, it is a world which is authentically Latin. Right, so in it, he's saying that there's some Native American element in there, you know, the old Red Indian admixture in Latin America, but still he's saying it's basically a Latin culture. The Latin stamp is immediately recognizable wherever it has been impressed. It is not a question of political complexion, but of culture. And around those societies which are properly called Latin, there are zones of sympathy and affiliation. A map of the countries which belong to this ambient could easily be drawn, and the extent of the zone it covered would prove astonishing. Numerous factors have contributed to form the psychology of the Latins. There is the Mediterranean climate, the geographical structure of the Mediterranean area, the profound influence of an ancient past, and the still directly perceptible influence of Rome. It is impossible to appreciate European civilization entirely except from the angle of this Latinism, because one is no longer really in Europe when one can no longer feel its presence. Although still Western, American civilization is distinguishable from that of the old world to the extent that the Latin factor ceases to affect it, or ceases to affect it directly. The climate of the Mediterranean has a character of its own. It is different from the neighboring climates of the Atlantic, of continental Europe, and of the Sahara, and it represents an area of clash and transition between them. I hope you're enjoying this, friends. This is an old book from 1952, if you missed last week's episode, and I really did think it was worth consulting it. I'm glad I'm doing this. I'm fascinating to read this account. Sometimes the influence of the Sahara is uppermost, and then it is the African summer of the Midi, dry, broiling, and relentless. Sometimes, on the other hand, the influence of the Atlantic is uppermost, and then there are tepid, rainy winters. The character of the Mediterranean climate is one of contrasts. Violent winds and vast and catastrophic rains, followed by tremendous inundations. The atmosphere is desert-like in its light, tropical in its deluges, and continental in the sudden onset of cold. However, and if you've ever been to holiday in Spain, you know exactly what he's talking about. However, the general impression is more African than European. When one comes from the north and arrives in the Mediterranean, it is not too much to say that to some extent one has left Europe behind. In France, the effect of this climate on the temperament of the inhabitants is felt primarily through the winds, which play a great role in their lives. The attitude of each individual is directly affected by it. There is a direct contrast between two types of wind: the sea wind, which relaxes, and the mistral, which excites. There is nothing corresponding to the west wind coming from the soothing depths of the ocean. Michelet, recalling Narbonne, describes the blasts of winds, violent or noxious, with some passions. And this is a quote: "A withering wind passes over the plains, straining the nerves to the utmost, despite the occidental curse. The violent and wholesome mistral, to which Augustus erected an altar, the warm, heavy, and putrefying wind of Africa, weighs on this land, and wounds heal slowly in Narbonne." And Alphonse Daudet speaks in the same way of the day of mistral in Nîmes country. He says, and this is a long quotation now from this Alphonse Daudet, he says, "Free and surmounting all obstacles as though chasing the immense undulating plain before it, on which a few small lost farm buildings look like the debris of a village scattered by the tempest. It passes like vapor across the sky, like flailing spray over the standing corn and over the olive groves, whirling the golden leaves around, and in sudden eddies it raises great clouds of yellow dust from under the wheels and bends down the clotheslines of the cypresses, and the long bush-leaved rushes at the side of the road, creating the illusion of a tossing stream. When it drops for a moment, as though out of breath, one can feel the full weight of summer, and an African heat rises from the ground, soon to be dissipated again by the wholesome and refreshing gusts of a wind, extending its reckless delight to the farthermost horizon, to the small grey and sombre hills which form the background of all provincial landscapes and which are bathed in iridescent fairy colours by the sunset. Beautiful description. Yeah, kind of interesting that he started off this chapter really talking about the wind and its impact on the individuals. Nowhere do people talk so much of the wind and the temperature as in Nîmes, Narbonne, and Carcassonne. The Mediterranean temperament, and in the wider sense the Latin temperament, derives directly from this climate, not only from those erratic winds, but also from the glorious light of a sun, already meridional, but not yet veiled by the oppressive melancholy of the tropics. In a magnificent passage, Jules Tellier, the poet of Le Havre, gives us a whole philosophy of meridional sunrise, and it helps us to understand the Midi in general. This is another long quotation, this time from Tellier. He says, "In the meantime, it grows lighter in the east. It is the dawn, the break of day. Nothing could be swifter, and there is none of the grandeur of the northern twilight. Not for one moment do we feel any sense of conflict, of a struggle whose upshot is doubtful, of heaven knows what obscure resistance by the powers of night and darkness. It all happens in the simplest and clearest possible fashion. Day breaks, that is all. Day comes as though to its own indisputable realm. It is almost as though night does not regard these lands as her own, and is therefore prepared to abandon them at the first challenge. From the preliminary vague lightness in the east, it is as though daylight comes with a kind of inevitability. There must of necessity be, and there is something lacking, a sense of disquiet and profundity in the poetry of peoples who experience the coming of day in this fashion. No, beyond all question, the poetry of the north is not at home among these peoples. Their own poetry is discreet. Its contours are clearly defined as though in miniatures. It is classic by contrast with the boreal romanticism of the north. At the same time, there is no doubt that diabolical winds and triumphant light exercise a very definite effect on their temperament. It is quite true that night does not regard these lands as her own. Their inhabitants are not made torpid by sleep, but at the same time, the wellsprings of their energy are necessarily erratic. The geography of that Mediterranean area in which the Latin spirit was formed encourages individualism, and the social spirit is limited to the clan. It is a geography of compartments, small isolated plains, very quickly circumscribed and hemmed in by mountains, which are never far away. A geography of clearly defined coasts favourable to maritime communications and to local commerce, which, however, can on occasion be extended far afield. A geography of pirates necessitating the construction of small fortified towns to defend the permanent settlements. A geography of aridity and torrential inundations demanding a system of irrigation, which involves at least a minimum of cooperation. And Latin civilization, if somewhat distant from its first cradle, still shows signs of these initial traits. That brilliant geographer, Fernand Moret, who died far too soon, wrote to me on January the 10th, 1929, in a letter which I have carefully preserved. And this is a quotation from his friend, this geographer, Fernand Moret. He says, "The economy of the Mediterranean countries is the irregular structure of a region where the mountains reach down to the sea, making as many separate compartments as there are small plains lapped by the sea. It is the structure of a country in which an irrigation policy is an absolute necessity, because left to itself, the land would be marsh if it were not drained, or a desert if it were not watered. A country in which the basis of settled life is not the field, as it is in our districts, but the garden, and the inhabitant is compelled by the formation of the land to cultivate it patiently and laboriously in terraces. A country in which the sea is not an obstacle to exchange, but on account of the numerous ports, the innumerable islands, and its own narrowness, the only convenient route for trade." Very strong geographical consideration so far. Very, very interesting. "Thus, such a society is clearly defined, local and diverse. It is the antithesis of a mass-produced civilization. And above all, it is a very ancient civilization. In Neolithic times, there were communities living there who were already far advanced by comparison with Northern Europe, where the lingering ice was an obstacle to population. On the meridional coasts of France, and in general on the Mediterranean coasts, there are more centuries of history underfoot than in the north. By the various stages of their successive architecture, the old churches indicate a layering of civilizations comparable to geological strata. The cathedral of the Béziers, the ruins of Enserun, and St. Ambrose at Milan were all witness to an immense past. As a result, the Mediterranean peoples, the Latins, have a natural sense of the past. They are in contact with remote history. Neither Rome, nor Greece, nor even the East is anything strange to them. These Latins are not a young people. They are mature, perhaps in some respects old. And most certainly, they are never, as for instance the English often are, childish. Hey! Anyway, let's carry on. Their psychology, which is the psychology of an adult, is explained by this question of age. They are skeptical, and they are rarely simpletons, even when they are superstitious. They are not generally naive. Their clarity of thought allows them to distinguish without difficulty between a principle and its application, and this capacity for intellectual disentanglement preserves them from moral hypocrisy, if not from a realism which can become cynical. Sorry for my knee-jerk reaction there. I am, of course, not English myself, being half Welsh and half Iranian. But I felt, I'm sitting here in England, I felt a bit defensive for a moment, but I think, generally speaking, these are very fair observations from Siegfried so far. Their clarity of thought allows them to distinguish without difficulty between a principle and its application, and this capacity for intellectual disentanglement preserves them from moral hypocrisy, if not from a realism which can become cynical. They are not followers of Rousseau. They do not believe that man is good. They place no confidence in him, and despite the magical of the meridional eloquence, they do not attach so much importance to words as is generally believed. With them, intelligence takes precedence over action, and it is an intelligence which expresses itself and externalizes itself with extraordinary ease. Rome has left her mark in these parts. To her, the Latins owe a certain social structure based on the family, the clan, and a system of patronage, institutions which are stronger, more solid, and more enduring than the state itself. They also owe her a certain conception of justice and law, written law, with a framework as clear and distinct as the profile of their bare mountains, and based on distrust, on a realism accepted as a matter of course, without the least shadow of illusion concerning human nature. And I can see where he's going with this. Not a coincidence that these people produced Machiavelli, of course. The contrast with the confidence, which is the basis of English law, a conception of equity in which as little as possible is written down, is striking. He's talking about the Roman law, of course. Here, amongst the Latins, everything is based on property meticulously defined, on the written contract, embracing every possible detail. Waldeck Rousseau put it definitively in a speech to the Senate on the 27th of July, 1903. Gentlemen, we are an old nation. We have a long history. We maintain the deepest possible roots in the past, and even those roots which one might suppose have died away still retain feeling, so much so that the least wound restores them to life and makes them felt by the whole organism. We are a country of law. We are Latins. We are of that race which regards written law as supreme necessity, and which regards it not merely as an abstract synthesis, but as the measure and safeguard of its rights. Quite far away from the handshake deal here, aren't we? A particular conception of the state, and in general of political authority, has arisen there. Amongst the Latins, the power of the state is regarded, is conceived of, as something outside and above the individual, as, so to speak, something transcendent. One conceives it as one conceives a weapon, and one can use it as an instrument of domination. The individual may defend himself against the state because he does not regard it as necessarily benevolent. Long experience has made him very sceptical in this matter, so much so that he is neither astonished nor very indignant that power, once it is obtained, is abused on his behalf, and that of his friends. This attitude is no doubt the explanation of the extraordinary passion the Latins bring to their political struggles. What a difference between this conception and the Anglo-Saxon idea of the state as the expression of the community, of the state as an agent and a servant of the citizen who has delegated it his powers. In this respect, the Roman Catholic Church has not educated its flock in the civic virtues in the same way as churches of the Presbyterian kind developed from Calvinism have done. And again, when we talk about realism, elite theory, and so on, notable Giordano Mosco, an Italian, Pareto was a Latin, George Mackell was half German, half Italian, so the Italian elite theorists, interesting. The feature which strikes one immediately in all these Latin conceptions is the clarity of their structure. The Latins possess an extraordinary capacity for analysis as well as for generalization. In every question they discern at once the principle involved and all the logical consequences, perhaps even remote, which must follow from whatever choice they make. They would sooner discuss principles than realities. They like their politics abstract, though they rely for the defense of their material interests, to which they are far from indifferent, on the most cynical opportunism and on the most ingenious resourcefulness. Moreover, this gift for analysis is inseparable from a great capacity for expression. The Latin tongues of clear design and structure lend themselves admirably to this. They seem almost to have been made for the Lepardi inscriptions. That is also their weakness, because the pleasure in using them is hedged around with treacherous allures. Some of them, Spanish, for example, are so sonorous and magnificent that the sheer pleasure of using them, of expressing oneself in them, can tend to replace not only action, but even thought itself. A South American who sings hymns of praise in favour of liberalism hardly feels any need to be liberal. And if he similarly praises legality, it seems to exhaust the energy he might have used to defend it. The Frenchman is less musical and lends a less ready ear to that sort of sensuality. But there are, nevertheless, certain splendid verses of Victor Hugo which are devoid of sense and readily permit us to imagine the temptation of using language for language's sake. In the light of what has been said, it is now possible for us to determine the principal psychological characteristics of the Latin peoples. As an individual, the Latin is consciously such, and he attaches great importance to expressing his individuality. Where the Anglo-Saxon, personally modest but aggressively proud of his country, cooperates devotedly, civic by tradition and by instinct, the Latin sees things above all from the standpoint of his own personality. He is proud and vain, and he desires to shine. He would be quite capable of sacrificing the success of the group to his own successes, and it is less an accepted duty than by an appeal to his honour that he can be persuaded to make a cooperative effort or to shoulder burdens. At the same time, there is no doubt that the Anglo-Saxon and the Latin are both egoists, each in his own fashion. But the Anglo-Saxon would be more inclined to make a mystique of the practical spirit, whereas the Latin would remain sceptical, possessing, incidentally, a greater sense of realism than the Anglo-Saxon. Action, in its modern form, which is organisation, is more in accordance with the capacities of the Anglo-Saxon. But in certain circumstances where the normal rule no longer holds good, and particularly in times of crisis, the Latin will extricate himself more easily from trouble. Cold and fundamentally not very sentimental, the sagacious Latin reveals himself as more resourceful. His eloquence and his great verbosity should not be allowed to deceive us, and most certainly they do not deceive him, except where he chooses to be deceived. We must confess that these individual characteristics are not favourable to the group. In fact, the Latin hardly ever rises above the first and more limited forms of association. But up to a point, he displays the passion and the fidelity of a partisan. He does not willingly go beyond the city, and he feels himself most at ease in the clan. He readily accepts the family, to use the very appropriate phrase of Henri Barbusse, as a narrow conspiracy. I am astonished again and again at the different notions the expression the family evokes for the Anglo-Saxon Protestant and the Latin Catholic. Amongst the Mediterraneans and in the civilization to which they have given rise, the association of ideas which arises is that of a homogeneous group of interests born of family relationship, and one has a feeling of something sacred, as though one has touched on that profound and mysterious element known as blood. Arising from the same association of ideas is the purity of woman, which the man, often himself immoral, defends with an oriental jealousy. The family, the clan, the city, the committee, the syndicate, the system of patronage, these are all solid realities for this type of man. The state, conceived as a transcendent imperium, is too far removed from reality, except that one must stand in well with those who control it and learn to use it for one's own ends. In such circumstances, political ability, in the Machiavellian sense, will be common, but there will be little civic feeling in the sense of Anglo-Saxon service. It is the great weakness of Latin societies that they have never succeeded in establishing solid and lasting political regimes. They go from anarchy to tyranny, and they hardly ever find the golden mean which comes so easily to the Swiss, the English, and the Dutch, all of whom have nothing Latin about them whatsoever. And I'll just interrupt here to say that in Shakespeare, for example, in Shakespeare's history plays, he's constantly talking about the common weal, like the idea of the common good or the common wealth and civic duty, even for a king, you know. And Siegfried is saying that for the Latin, this kind of sense of civic duty is basically missing. They see the state as a means of his own enrichment, is of his own furtherment. And it's kind of interesting to think about, certainly Latin America in this context, because it kind of seems true, doesn't it? Anyway, let's carry on. The Latin displays the same limitations side by side with the same individual gifts in the sphere of production. He is ingenious, fertile in experience, resourceful, to use an expression which is unfortunately too popular with us at the moment. And when his work interests him, he is capable of devoting himself to it with the creative passion of an artist. His vanity can sometimes produce the same result because he is eager to distinguish himself, to let people know that he is there, even all there, to use a vulgarism. In this respect, he is clearly superior to the Anglo-Saxon and to the Nordics in general. He is a shrewd businessman, able, prudent, thrifty, and blunt. He does best in small businesses, but he is also capable of succeeding in larger ones. Whenever suppleness, diplomacy, and even intrigue are necessary, he is in his element. This is also the case whenever the individual can put forward individual arguments. And in Latin countries, managements attach as much importance to men as they do to things, so that often a friend must be made before a customer can be won. There is, I admit, a certain human element in all this, which tends to upset organization, but at the same time, it does facilitate matters. However, precisely these qualities give rise to defects in large-scale industrial production, because in an age where the great thing is to organize and to administer, the conditions for success are fundamentally at variance with the ambient in which the individual best succeeds. At one time, the Mediterranean was the economic center of the world, but since the oceans were mastered and new worlds opened up, this has changed. And in particular, since the Industrial Revolution, which is not based on the individual capacity of the producer, but on the mechanical organization in an age which is fast becoming collective, one sees individual Latins succeeding in Anglo-Saxon societies even better than the Anglo-Saxons themselves. But for all that, it is not Latin societies which are economically renewing the world. There is something in the Latin makeup which is at variance with the mass achievements of our age. A certain collective anonymity in the giant undertakings of our day, which is at variance with the Latin genius. Does that mean that it is out of date? Perhaps it does, where quantity is the thing desired, but there is still room for it when it is a question of quality. Whatever the achievements of Anglo-Saxon and Nordic culture, Europe would not be the same without the contribution of Latin culture. It is this Latin element which maintains that classicism in our old continent, which, more than any other characteristic, determines its individuality. And it is precisely that which accounts for the maturity which distinguishes our continent from the youth of the United States and the pseudo-youth of Russia. The Latin is overreadily regarded as erratic, but he has as a fund of wisdom and moderation in his private life, which the man of more northern climes can never match. The Latin is also regarded as less moral, but his lack of illusions extends in his heart of hearts to his own person as well, vain as he is, and I am inclined to believe that a certain intellectual sincerity is more often to be found in him than in the hypocrites of the North, who lack the courage to look into their own hearts. In this, the Latin genius reflects one of the abiding aspects of the human spirit. And I'm kind of as I'm reading this, I'm thinking about certain American commentators I listen to and thinking, I can kind of like, I'm not going to name any names, but there's certain people I'm thinking of. I think I recognize some of these things that he's talking about in them, this kind of the lack of illusions, the realism that he's talking about. There's two people in particular I have in mind, American commentators. that certainly fit this description, and they tend to be a little bit more cynical than some of the quote-unquote Nordics around them that they have conversations with. Anyway, let's continue. There is thus, beyond all question, a Latin civilization with its own specific Latin atmosphere. It is perhaps difficult to analyze its elements, but it can be reorganized by something not easily put into words, by a certain presence, by something I don't know quite what in the surrounding air, by some special quality in the light. Once one has crossed the frontier coming from abroad, it is impossible to mistake it. Go down from Central Europe towards the Mediterranean, go down from North America to that America which is so justly called Latin, and the impression is the same. You meet a certain way of life, of government, of morals, a certain artistic spirit, and in a form which is, it is difficult to define, a certain spiritual liberty. Consider the zone, those limits we have sketched above. Like a tide, Latinism has spread outwards, though sometimes it has flowed back again from certain territories it had conquered. Its farthest limits were approximately those of the Roman Empire in ancient times, and outside Europe, Spanish and Portuguese America. However, today it is far from occupying all the territory of the Roman Empire. The more the northern parts of the Roman Empire, which incidentally were never fully peopled by Latins, were subsequently overrun by Germanic, Slav, and Mongol elements insensible to Mediterranean influences. The result is a Europe whose centers of gravity, whose modern sources of efficiency, no longer principally derive from Latin influence. For instance, the Romania of yesterday, Latin by language and culture, is no longer Latin either by race or civilization, except by courtesy. And France, ethnically Celtic and Germanic, more than Mediterranean, is truly Latin only in her meridional area. Although the combination of the Lycee, of the Lycee and classic education has made Frenchmen Latins in attitude and spirit. Spanish and Portuguese America have had Latin characteristics so strongly impressed on them that not even the prestige of the United States itself has so far succeeded in weakening them. The danger there is internal, rather. Where the climate is equatorial and of the Andes, it is native Indian and colored traits which tend to recur and threaten to corrupt the more recent tradition which has Latinized that part of the world. Thus, the frontiers are beginning to become clear. The Latin frontiers of Europe are those of the Roman Empire, and when we are discussing the problems of our old continent and the solutions they call for, we can hardly pay too much attention to the map of Rome's former possessions, because reactions are very different in those parts where the Pax Romana, Roman law and Roman property rights once held sway. We must also study the chart of Christianity's progress, because the Latin genius was impressed on the initial barbarian layer of Europe, not only by the Roman Empire, but also by the Roman Catholic Church. It is not a matter of indifference for our purposes whether this or that country has been Christian for 1800 years, whilst others have been Christian for only 5 or 6 centuries. It is in this sense that the Slav, and to a limited extent, the German areas are only partly Christian, sorry, only partly European, he says. A different world, a world in which we can turn too easily in the other direction, begins with the glacial northern plain, with the Teutoburg Forest and the where Varus lost his legions. With the appropriate differences, the American continent reveals analogous distinctions, Anglo-Saxon and Latin or Indian, and the geographic unity of the New World is hardly enough to cloak a diversity of cultures which still exists and which centuries may never succeed in eliminating. There was a time when the mastery of the world was disputed between the Mediterranean peoples and the peoples of the North. Today, the rivalry is less between the North and the South than between the West and the East. whereby the West takes on its own specific personality, in which the Latin contribution is visible in all its importance. It was not Latin Europe which made the Industrial Revolution, and we have sought to show why, but in consequence people are inclined to underestimate the true importance of the essential role which still devolves on the Latin world. The Latin point of view, in the discussion of our problems and even in our very conception of life itself, represents an indispensable factor of our civilization, and it is perhaps with its assistance that we can obtain the highest and most disinterested level of culture, a culture of quality and refinement of spirit, and more literary than scientific. Later we shall discuss the irresistible dynamism of the Anglo-Saxons. As far as the Latins are concerned, they possess a marvellous capacity for consciously disengaging thought from action, and thus permitting thought to come face to face with reality, dispensing with the mediation of any surrounding atmosphere. This is the supreme guarantee of full intellectual liberty. Might not a de-Latinized world lose this precious capacity? And that's where he ends. A really very interesting discussion indeed. And honestly, as I was reading it, there were a few moments where I was like, where's he going with this? But by the end, I certainly recognize a lot of what he's talked about, both in my own travels, people I've met, as I mentioned, certain content creators I can think of who clearly come from a kind of Latin background. And I recognize all of these things that he's talking about. Very interesting. Can't wait to get to the French, English and German chapters in the coming weeks. I'm sure it's going to generate a bit of controversy as well. Even the couple of comments you made about the English so far, even I had a reaction, and you know, I'm not even English. So anyway, cheers, everyone. Catch me again tomorrow morning. Do buy a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll see you next time. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.